Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's September 14th, 2014, and welcome to episode 83 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz? Will I ever find my way?
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and just idly chatting. With me today is Michael Mulhern. How are you?
I'm good.
And special guest today is Mike Whalen.
Hey.
Good day. I guess good day probably went to Michael. But so I'm the only non-Michael here. In a surprise turn of events, Carrington and Steve and Earl all are no-shows. So we'll see how this goes. We all feel like the new guys.
But they're off having their own podcast.
That's right. But so anyway, anything interesting happening with you down there, Michael?
Well, I've started putting my VZ300 kit together. That's a Dick Smith VZ300, which is made by VTech, little Taiwanese company that made a lot of computers, and they were rebadged around the world. Not quite sure what it was called in the US, but they were pretty big in the UK and the Asia Pacific area. But yeah, apart from that, it's just been a lot of work on my new acreage. I'm getting a better understanding of the various painkillers that are available over the shelf, and have been self-administering.
Great.
Yeah, I just don't self-administer for too long.
No. Dr. Steve will be very upset with me.
Yes. Right.
And so Mike got called at the very last second and was very gracious in being able to join us. What have you been up to?
Well, I'm not even wearing clothes.
The beauty of podcasting.
So, no, you know, actually, this is the first time I'm doing this from a room that I finally set up. I went over to, on the way to K-Fest this year, I went over to Michael Sternberg's, and he and I carpooled. And he had all these rooms set up with equipment, different retro computers and whatnot. And I said, oh, this is why I'm not using anything that I have. I don't have anything set up. I had like my 2GS on a floor, and I would occasionally sit there and basically until I felt like enough pain that I needed to get up. So, but yeah, I'm finally set up. I have this new office here, I suppose. It's just a repurposed room that has the 2C Plus that I picked up at K-Fest and the 2GS sitting next to it. And now it's starting to collect some debris, but I'm not nearly as good at it as you are, Paul.
Yes. Well, yeah. I guess
is that setting up computers or setting up an office? He's very good at collecting bits and pieces. Very.
Yeah, I'm talking about the debris. He's really good at collecting debris.
Yes, it's mainly debris. I had tweeted a picture of my office, I think, at some point, and recently with the Lisa peeking out, and it's really just horrible.
Is that what that was?
I promise. I will clean it up. But
no, don't. I mean, yeah. It's a quintessential professorial office too. So
right, exactly.
I like to call it creative clutter.
Yeah.
What surprises me is that I actually get very few comments from people who are just meeting me, you know, about my normal job. You know, the students that come in and talk to me. Nobody. Sometimes people say, "Oh, that's a lot of monitors," but that's the end of the curiosity. So that's unfortunate. But
they're probably thinking, "Yo, his office is so neat and tidy. I hope he never sees mine."
Right. So, and yeah, I guess what I've been doing, I've been kind of, I've been traveling a little bit and spending a fair amount of time kind of constructing things for other podcasts and stuff. So I haven't actually had much retrocomputing time recently, but oh well. Anyway, so the continuing host topic that we're working on for the next few episodes is the milestones of the 1980s. Since this is episode 83, we're talking about the milestones of 1983. And so we'll just walk through a couple of things that came out or were introduced in 1983. So we all have here in front of us a list. I'll just kind of go through some of them. So Apple came out with the Lisa and the Apple IIe in 1983. Yay! Those were obviously fairly significant milestones. Sometimes I forget that the 2E and the Lisa are sort of contemporaneous because I think of them in different lines.
Well, they're just so different machines from the same company at the same time. It almost feels like the Lisa and the Macintosh should fall like a lot, I don't know, much further in the future than the 2E.
So do either of you have a Lisa or experience with one?
No, the only Lisa time I've had is using one of the emulators. My oldest GUI Apple is a 512K Mac, so that's a few shows down the track before that one comes up. But all my retro computing is Z80 and 6502 based. So yeah, all these magical GUI things are really in the future to me.
And not me. I have a recollection of having used one. I mean, not for anything of any consequence. When I started off in my professional career, I was working in the printing industry, and there were a few. It was what they called a VAR, value added reseller. Mm-hmm. So they sold Apple equipment at the time, and I recall that they had a Lisa. Somebody had one, and they brought it in, and we poked at it for a little while and said, "Oh, that's weird. It's kind of like a Mac, but it's slow," and that was it.
Well,
interesting you should say. 1983 was basically when I started working for local computer reseller in Brisbane in Queensland, Computers and Peripherals. So they basically had the Apple II line of computers, HP calculators, a whole lot of other scientific and engineering calculators. In the quaint way that things were done in the past, they had the state government contract for supplying calculators. So whenever some state government employee required a new calculator or upgrade service or whatever, it would come through our shop. So yeah, I was an early user of the calculators, and I had moved from university. University and I parted company. I was had got enthralled with these computer things, didn't manage to complete my foundation year, and was spending time doing programming for various lecturers and schools at the university, and not concentrating on what I was there for. So I needed to go out and get a paying job.
I sort of feel like we don't almost need to talk a lot about the impact of the Lisa because it's sort of so well known in our
right.
in our ethos. But I do have a Lisa 2. I think it was a Lisa 210 initially, and it turns on, but I actually have not done very much with it. I have a compact flash based hard drive for it, so I've turned it on. You know, actually the keyboard doesn't work because they have these foam pads underneath them that all deteriorate with time, and I haven't fixed that. So, so it's mainly just, you know, I turn it on, I click some stuff, I click shut down, you know, that's about it. Actually,
The foam pads, they can be a real pain. My wife's actually into knitting machines of that age and even older, and there's quite a few foam pads that are in them, and invariably when she gets a new old knitting machine, one of the first things I've got to do is strip it down and remove the disintegrated foam pads that are in there and rebuild all those beds and everything. So I suppose I'm picking up a little bit of mechanical repairs and things along the line. But once that foam disintegrates and goes to sort of like almost a glue in places and escapes from where it's supposed to be, it can be a real pain.
There are a couple of I've seen a couple of things online that demonstrate sort of how you can remake these pads. And the pads, these keyboard pads, are in the Lisa, but they're also in, I think, some Franklins and some Compaqs, maybe. There are definitely other computers of the era that used foam pads return the keys.
A cheap way of returning their keys from the downstroke. But, yeah.
So let's see. 1983 seems to have been... in many ways, just kind of 1982 version 2. We have a lot of clones. We have a lot of the IBM PC XT came out.
That's a biggie.
Advancement of the PC. I don't know. I think the XT actually lasted. I don't know the history of it that well, but I think the XT lasted for a fairly long time. I think it supplanted the PC fairly quickly. The Franklin Ace 1200. I guess this was, does anyone know? I think this is an Apple II clone advancement.
This is the heyday of the Apple II clones as well, all over the place. I was trying to find out when there was an Apple II clone released in Australia called the Wombat, and I'm trying to find the release date for that one.
Cool.
Yeah, that's a great name, certainly. TRS-80 Model 100 and TRS-80 Model 4. Both those I'm sort of interested in myself. I have a couple of these Model 100s, and we talk about them repeatedly. The Model 4, I only became sort of aware of that recently, but they're partly because there's a portable version, a luggable version of the Model 4 as well. But
well, the Model 100 is certainly something that I and a lot of people I knew at the time lusted after. We were into BBSs, and this whole idea that you could bring your computer anywhere and hook it up to any phone line and call your favorite BBSs was too exciting for words at the time, but I couldn't afford it. I remember that was one of the things that I actually tried to convince my dad that I was good for credit somehow at, I think, 12 years old or 13 years old at the time. So he didn't believe me.
So much earning potential from then on, though.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, the Model 100, I think, was that had a pretty big impact. I think the particular journalists and that was fairly long lived and widely used. It's unfortunate. One of the things that's in this list is the Epson QX10, and it is unfortunate that Earl is not here because he is our resident QX10 expert. That was definitely a neat machine. We talk about it periodically throughout the podcast, but it's a CPM machine, it's a fairly well developed machine. I used one myself for a little while, and I have a couple of them now, but this is basically just the way my collection goes. I have many of these things, and all of them are on my to-do list, so I haven't really done much more than just get it to a point where it starts up and says insert diskette.
No. Well, did you?
I did, and then it turned out the disk drive didn't work.
Oh.
so it, in that way, much like my K-Pro.
Oh, well, that's definitely a pizza box computer. Goodness. Maybe,
Yeah, they're pretty cool, though, I mean, my own connection to it is mainly nostalgic. You know, I had that was the computer that had the 1200 baud modem, you know, so I could call the fancy bulletin board systems.
Ooh.
With it.
Yeah.
I did actual paid programming work in DBase on it. And Epson, Earl sold them and has long wanted an Epson QX10. I don't know if he has one now, but long time ago, just before I think I started on this podcast, I beat him at an eBay auction for one, and I've been
beat him. Okay, all right.
Been
yeah.
sort of sad about it ever since. But let's see. So another couple of things that came out in 1983 were game system computers. So the Mattel Aquarius and the Coleco Atom. I never had any of these at the time, and I don't have an Atom now. Does anyone have any experience with them?
No, I wasn't into the consoles back then. I still haven't got into the console games. So it was an interesting time, but especially ones that come with the turn your console into a computer add-ons.
Yeah, I didn't have one at the time. The Atom looked exciting in some ways, but I had a Commodore 64 at the time, and I guess. Well, that was the better horse to bet on, at least at the time. I didn't know anybody who got an Atom. Now, as far as the Aquarius, I got one much later. I don't recall my reasons for getting it, but I played with it for a little while. It's an interesting little computer, and people are doing really interesting things with it. I think the last time I was on, we talked about that actually a little bit, but it was interesting. I mean, it was definitely a shift, like, you know, the game company saw the deer, and they were like the deer in the headlights, and they saw, oh, wait, this is all kind of crashing around us. We got to get onto this computer thing. And thus was the Atom and the Aquarius and various other computers like that. So, but they are now littering the road.
Yeah, so. I think the main reason that I didn't get into the consoles is that I saw that the games were as good or better on a computer, and you could also program it more easily. And I just felt that even though the computer systems were more expensive, that they were a much better proposition. But I suppose, as I said, at this stage, I was actually, you know, making money writing programs. So, sort of, it was more like a backward step to me. I thought, oh yeah, that's something that you can have in the house for the kids to play with, and wouldn't really worry about it. And I just sort of like heads down, hand to the keyboard, and working away on getting the software developed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think for me, I don't think I would have been. I don't think I knew the Aquarius at all at the time, and maybe just kind of, you know, knew peripherally about the Atom, but I'm sure at the time I wouldn't have been interested, because, you know, it really, once you already are into computers, they're very limited. So, but they're sort of interesting in retrospect. So one thing I know about the Coleco Atom is that if you ever are trying to buy one now, you have to be very careful that you get the printer, because the printer is actually where the power is. So if you don't have the printer, you can't turn it on.
Oh, that's a weird decision in retrospect, but I'm sure it made sense to somebody at the, what's the name of that? It's like the Connecticut Leather Company. Yeah, that's what Coleco used to stand for.
Yeah. So let's see. There's a list of Atari advancements, you know, so, and I think, so the 600 XL, 800 XL, 1450 XL, 1450 XLD. And my Atari background is fairly poor, but I think these are all 800 compatible, right?
Well, I don't know about that. I was going to say that I think that these, this is kind of represents Jack Tramiel's stamp on the design of the line. Because these are all, if I recall correctly, these are all in the new style, the new 80s style of Atari 8-bit computers.
Which I don't like very much, but nevertheless, I've still considered getting them just to try the software.
An 800 XL would be kind of nice.
Let's see. So, I'll skip on to devices unless anyone sees anything else.
Well, the only one that was released in 83 was the VTEC Laser 200, which is the one that was rebadged around the world. So that's my Dick Smith Electronics VZ200. That's a Z80 based machine. And having a look here, that was Scandinavia, the Solora Fellow, the Textet TX8000 in the UK, but I can't see anything for that US base, so maybe it didn't quite get into the US.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Paul.
Oh, sorry about that. One thing that I was about to skip and shouldn't is the Compaq.
Ah, that's what I was about to ask. Is that the one that halt and caught fire?
Right. I assume that. So the Halt and Catch Fire show is I think kind of modeled around the Compaq story.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. So that had a big impact. I think the Osborne was before it, but Compaq really, well, first of all, Compaq is a PC clone rather than a CPM machine, but that really took off.
Yeah.
So devices, we have in the list here, we have Apple letter quality printer. I didn't put it in the list.
I think Steve dropped that one in.
okay.
But he's a little bit more Apple centric than the rest of us. But that was I'm just trying to remember which one that was a rebadge of. Apple at that stage had the ImageWriter 1, which was a Scioto 8510 rebadged. They kept that one going until the end of 84. But yeah, there was quite a large range of dot matrix printers there. Most of them were the around the 9-pin. So to get a near letter quality dot matrix printer was actually quite good. And back then, there was quite a discernible difference in the dot matrix near letter quality. Of course, what they meant by near letter quality was nearly as good as a daisy wheel, which was really just, to me, daisy wheel's just a glorified typewriter style printer. But great for letters, but I went with the ImageWriter so that I had a good solid base machine that I could do listings and also do pin control on it so that you could actually get graphics printed out on it, with just a black ribbon, not quite at the stage where you've got your colored dot matrix printers. But no, this is basically, I think, the zenith of the dot matrix era. Everything from now on is basically just more pins. So, you know, your 24-pin letter quality printers and whatnot. So quite an interesting time printer-wise. Pretty much the death of the thermal printer now. Everyone has moved on to the dot matrix. It was fun. I must admit that the ImageWriter or the Scioto 8510 that it was, now that is a solid printer. I think the weight of it was greater than my computer, my monitor, and all my disk drives added together as far as weight goes. And it was still only used the 8.5 by 11 paper.
Yeah, it doesn't matter how hard the wind is blowing, it will not blow away.
No.
So another couple things that were in here were the Microsoft mouse, and I think this is the early two, like the green button one, and then the Bernoulli box. On the Microsoft mouse, I mean, I don't have any real experience with this particular one. The Intella, what was it called? The Intella mouse that came out much later.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is worthy of mention. I'm not completely sure that the little green button one is, but does anyone have any comment on it?
I guess other than the fact it was the first one, perhaps, for them, you know, it's notable in that way.
Yeah. And it had two buttons. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was, you know, at that stage, everything was still, to me, was command line. I was, you know, aware of the Lisa being out there, and I'd seen magazine pictures of it and the mouse. I knew what the mouse was, but it wasn't until much later on that I went and got a mouse for one of my Apple II computers, and even then I was still just writing software that utilized the mouse on a text-based screen. So I had a whole screen input systems and was just using the mouse. So quite different from today, where you've got the mouse pointer zipping around your graphical screen. On what I was doing was basically just a inverse character square moving around. I wasn't even using mouse graphics that Apple supplied. I was trying to keep the software compatible across any machine that could support a mouse on a serial card. So I'll have to dig out some of that early software that I was writing, if only to remind me how we sort of like made hacks and shortcuts and whatnot to get things to work in that. Because at that stage, I was still only writing for Apple systems with 48K. I was even trying to avoid using anything above 48K to make sure it was compatible with the largest number of computers within the university. So.
So all three of us here certainly started with our own computer systems, with the keyboard being the main method of input. Now, you guys still find that you prefer or more comfortable with the keyboard as the main method of input? Because I certainly find that I do. I prefer applications and utilities that I can call up with a keyboard to type in applications that I want to run, things like that, instead of defaulting to and feeling more comfortable with the mouse or the trackpad.
Yeah, I was pretty much keyboard only for the longest time, but these days, although I'm probably using keyboard shortcuts more than most people, when I'm doing Perl programming on our AIX systems here, I'm using Windows obviously for the PuTTY session. Right. I'm using Notepad Plus to as my editor, so you know I'm moving the mouse, highlighting there. But a lot of the other editing, I'm doing it all on the keyboard.
I definitely I definitely prefer keyboard when I can. I use launchers on my Mac, and anything that I can, it's often kind of annoying to have to like break and move off to click something or highlight.
Yeah, the fingers are typing on the keys, and it is a break. To me, it's a break in concentration, so that on what I'm doing. So I'm moving back and forth. But yeah, I'm still, suppose I'm now down to about 50-50 keyboard to mouse.
Well, certainly modern UIs are definitely a lot more mouse and point-click sensible than anything else. But I still, if I can implement something that allows me to still use the keyboard, I certainly prefer it a lot more. Just more comfortable, that's all.
Yeah, the trackpad has helped a little bit by putting it kind of right, you know, at your I don't know, fingertips in a way. But I'm wondering actually if maybe a trackball might be better, because you could run it with your thumbs, so you would still be able to stay on the keyboard. Anyway, Bernoulli Box was the other device that was here. Had a couple things.
Storage system that didn't really make it.
Everybody remembers it.
Yeah, I had the PCs and the XTs that I used back in the ancient history. We had one of the 10 and 20 8-inch cartridge Bernoulli Box, and I think that's what has come out here in 1983. And those were cool. They were almost as fast as a hard drive, it seemed like it was a cheap hard drive that you could take home with you. They make a nice sound. I have a couple now.
I just happened to have a 150 megabyte Bernoulli disk here in its case up here on my shelf in front of me. I basically came across a box of 10 of them for almost a giveaway price. It actually cost me more to have it shipped from the US than it did to actually buy them. But I kept it because it basically just looks like a giant floppy disk. So I'll just pop it out. It's got a massive steel gate on it, just like a 3.5-inch floppy disk. It's got a write protect button, I suppose, mechanical. It was an interesting technology. I'm doing this sort of like back to front. I've now got the Bernoulli disks, and I suppose what I'm looking for now is a drive to use them on.
You do realize this is an audio podcast, right?
I do. Yeah.
Okay.
I could see it. I was looking at a picture, though.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. All Michaels are psychic. We have a connection. Right. What one sees, all sees.
Exactly.
Well, I saw them at the very tail end of their popularity. It was very quickly, at least in the places I was going, supplanted by PsyQuest at first, and then Jazz and Zip and things like that.
Well, and Zip and Jazz and Zip are you know, extensions. I mean, I think they're a different technology, but still the same company that made Bernoulli initially.
iOmega.
A different technology to go for the same sort of thing. So, yeah, I've got a whole pile of Zip 100 and 250 disks with software just still sitting there.
And every once in a while, somebody will come to me with a bag of 100 megabyte Zip disks and a parallel Zip disk drive. They say, oh, can you get this stuff off? Well, I can try.
It's a good thing I've got a USB one, so,
So let's see. Yes. 1983 continues in the software. There are a couple of big software releases here, but and I feel sort of bad actually burying this in the middle of the 1983 discussion, but I will do so anyway. Lode Runner came out in 1983, so that was you know, sort of a... That was a pretty major thing, ported to many, many platforms. And the reason that it's kind of notable at this moment is that the creator of the game initially, Doug E. Smith, just passed away. Or at least it was just reported a couple days ago. So that's sad, because this had a huge impact, and I think it was it was definitely one of the first games that allowed you to actually edit, you know, like make your own levels and really impacted a lot of people.
Yeah, it was my favorite arcade style game for me, the Apple II, but on so many platforms. You could go over to, you know, any of your friend's place and play Lode Runner, regardless of what computer they had. And to me, that was my game as far as arcade games go. And early episodes, we had my favorite role-playing game, Wizardry. So that's my two big ones taken care of. But it was very sad the other day to see the postings come up that Doug Smith had passed away. But
And it had a lot of legs, that's for sure, because it wound up on a ton of platforms. You know,
I think there was even an arcade cabinet version of it at some stage.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
It was actually also fairly recently released in on the iPhone too. So there's like an iOS version.
Hmm.
Oh, that'd destroy my eyesight going down to trying to play that on such a small screen. But maybe I'll have to get myself a big iPhone to play it on.
Yeah, that's as good a reason as any.
Mm.
Also, Lotus 1-2-3 is on the list.
Never heard of it.
That pretty much just took over from VisiCalc.
Yeah.
Mm.
I use the sequel 4-5-6, a little bit lesser known.
MIDI. MIDI interface developed.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
It is a big deal. Not something I've used, but once you can actually use computers as sequencers in a standardized way, that opened it up, I'm sure, to quite a lot more artists. And then someone want to talk about the next one?
Well, the next one is basically the IT word processor. It took a while to get moving, but really it has destroyed all in its path. So in 1983, a little company called Microsoft released Multi-Tool Word. So they've got rid of the multi-tool, and now it's just known as Word. They released that for DOS and Xenix as well. So that was the big release by Microsoft for 83.
They announced
something which they didn't quite get right for quite a while, but they announced that in 1984 they would be releasing a product called Windows. They didn't get round to releasing it in 84, so we'll have to wait until show 85 to talk about Windows version 1 when it was released. But, the biggie was Word.
And Word, as you can see, Microsoft was already great at naming products. Multi-tool Word. Now, there was a video floating around a little while, a number of months ago, it was like somebody getting a demonstration of the, a pretty early version of Windows. Do we know, was that the 84 or the 85 version?
Well, Windows 1, which I have a copy of, that didn't come out till 85. I suppose there were people with pre-release ones. So, I suppose there have to be a YouTube video of someone using Windows 1 there somewhere.
It was a YouTube video of somebody at a CES seeing it demonstrated. It was like, it was, I don't know how you could call it Windows. It was like a single window application.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, so, well, that's that. Yeah. We'll save all the lovely bits of Windows 1. Oh, that's right, there weren't any. It was basically just a DOS shell, more so than the later versions. One application at a time. So basically, it was just really a coherent interface for the stuff. It was still floppy based. The one I've got was designed for twin 5.25-inch disk systems. So it wasn't even really hard drive aware directly, but it could. But Microsoft, little small company and big things to come.
Yes.
So I think we can sort of wrap up the 1983 review, a couple of events. So John Sculley became president of Apple. Does anyone here, do either of you know about TI, this TI bullet?
Not more than the fact that I was aware of it. So, yeah, the TI-99-2, and again, I only know of it, not about it. Of course, most of us have got the familiarity with the 99-4A.
Right.
But this was basically, I think, TI basically took a massive nosedive.
I had never heard of the 99.2 and 99.8 before.
I had, but only in the context of Texas Instruments being in a price war with Tremeil at Commodore. Mm-hmm. So, and that was their big thing. That's kind of what they had to exit the market. They couldn't compete on that, on price.
Mm. Yeah.
Which is odd, you know, but for Texas Instruments, but they couldn't, so...
Maybe they made the decision to get out. It was, you know, they couldn't continue it as a lost leader for their other products and ended up just, I think, concentrating on their microcontrollers and other bits and pieces.
Right.
Okay, so I think we can leave 1983 there, and next time we'll go into 1984.
I think a few things were there for 84, but stay tuned and find out.
And I guess that's what? That's some number of decades, right? It's 2014 now. But, okay, so we have a couple of listener feedbacks that we've gotten from people. So Duncan writes asking about looking for advice on adding an Apple II, like I always feel a little bit self-conscious about all Apple all the time here, but nevertheless, this was reader feedback. The question is basically just quickly, anyway, what kind of advice we might have about what Apple II model to shoot for if you're shooting for one.
Yeah, well, if you're looking to add one Apple II into your collection, and he said he's got a small collection, so he also puts a caveat on there. The only one that doesn't get his juices flowing is the 2C. So I think I might have to put my Mike McGuinness hat on here from No Quarter and ban Duncan from the show. But no, I'd recommend a 2E Platinum. Pretty much, to me, that is... the biggest and the best of the 2E styled computers. I still think if you're after a small compact Apple II with the lot, then I would go with Apple IIc, maybe a 2C plus. But if you want to go with the E range, I'd be going with the Platinum with the numeric keyboard. It allows you to chuck your peripherals in also bring it into the modern day with a CFFA card and any of the other interface cards that are available. Even putting a Raspberry Pi on a card for your machine and hook it up that way. But yeah, so Mike, what would you recommend as adding an Apple II into a small collection?
Well, it just so happens that I kind of went through this whole process because I'm having so little familiarity with the Apple II line in general, and then going to Kansas Fest, I wanted to get my hands on something. And I think like Duncan says here, that the net, the internet, suggests a 2GS. And I think that that's definitely a valid answer, considering it's basically backward compatible with most everything. But, and I did get a GS, but there's one thing that it does not fill, and that is the need to touch something that looks like it's from a different era. The Apple IIGS kind of looks like a 90s, early 90s era Macintosh. So it doesn't feel old enough. And the Platinum 2E is probably like a really good answer, but it still has a little bit of a newness feeling. The Platinum 2E is great because it's new enough that I think you're going to find ones that are in relatively good shape. I think that the farther you go back, you're going to find ones that are more and more broken or have various problems that the owners couldn't get resolved, like problems with the keyboard and things like that. But, you know, it's not going to – if you want something that is going to fill that aesthetic need to play with something from the 1980s, then even the 2E before the Platinum one would probably fit that bill, my opinion.
Yeah, I think that makes sense too. The 2C Plus is one of the later, better – Apple II models, and you know that it really depends on what you want to try to do with it. I was going to suggest the 2C Plus, except because it's for one thing, it's got a very fast clock. It can go 4 megahertz, I think. You know, it has ADB plugs, and you know, it doesn't require a power brick and all these nice sort of modern amenities. But in a way, that actually just turns it into not much more of a different experience than just using an emulator. And so I think probably the Platinum 2E or an enhanced 2E just before that would probably be what I would suggest too, just because you have the slots and you can actually sort of play with it. You have a regular sort of Apple II type keyboard. So
yeah, but the 2C Plus has that kind of weird beep.
Did I just hear one?
You did. Yes, you did.
So I guess that's the answer is it depends a little bit on what you're trying to do, but the 2E Platinum seems to be a good.
Yeah, I'd have to agree that the GS, although it can do everything that you want, it's backward compatible with the two traditional range. It does, to me, I agree, look too much like a more modern machine, so like something that's something from the 90s rather than something from the 80s.
Right.
But, yeah, I can see where you're coming from as far as maybe going a bit older than the 2E Platinum. But, yeah, I think that if you're after a single machine of the Apple II range, that's where you've got to be looking at. And, of course, it all comes down to what you can pick up from where.
Right. Yeah, and just to wrap it up, one thing I would suggest is I like the 2C. I have a 2C Plus here. It has a green monitor, and it's very cool looking. But the 2GS with that CFFA 3000 card is just – it's beautiful. So if you're going to buy one thing, I think it would be an Apple IIe enhanced or a Platinum that has the slots that you can put a CFFA in there, because it'll just make your experience so much more interesting.
Let's see, and there's a second bit of feedback that I was going to address, although I feel like I do not have the expertise for it. But I'll say the question anyway, and maybe if either of you have something that you...
I'm going to say no, not me. But
so the question is, maybe we'll get more feedback with the answer, but the question is essentially... So let me just read a little bit of this. Mm-hmm. So the subject is, why didn't 6502 computers get faster? This is from Vince. And so he says, well, one of the things that struck me at the beginning is, he says, I'm 22, so I wasn't around for the 8-bit era, and find you guys to be a wonderful source of information, et cetera, et cetera. But that's great. actually, that we have somebody who's didn't grow up with them but is still interested in you know, these. And I think there really is a merit to these, you know, computers of the 80s just from the simplicity standpoint. But the question he was asking was, why did the 6502 stay at 1.02 megahertz for a decade? You know, this is not something that we see now. Now, you know, pretty much every 6 months there's a speed bump. So why was that okay? And what prevented it from really sort of speeding up? And the answer to this I have no clue about, really.
Well, to me, I did a little bit of looking up on this, and to me it came more down to, it's not that they couldn't be made to go any faster, it's just that they didn't. So you had the 650X range of chips, and everything within that range could use a common command set. So it was fairly consistent. So when you use something like CC65 cross compiler, you can create software for a wide range of machines because they shared that chipset family, and it was available for such a long time, and it got used so much because it was available in large numbers at a very cheap price compared to everything else that was available.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the next generation that did come after that was the 65816. That's the basically the CPU that is a variant in the 2GS. So that introduced the 16-bit, still on an 8-bit data bus. Speeds were faster, and it contained a 6502 emulation, so it could still take and process programs written for 6502, which is effectively why the 2GS was so backwardly compatible with the previous two series machines. Unfortunately, that's where that family stops.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really think that it's for any reason that there was no way of moving to a next generation after that. I just think that at that stage, Intel were pretty much tying up the market with their CPU. The companies that had been using the 650X family of CPUs, they were going by the way. Apple themselves had moved on to the Motorola 68000 series, mm-hmm. Which then later continued into the PowerPC, and then on they then moved to G3, G4s, 5s, and then even eventually they've moved back to Intel for their desktop computers. But I think it's more of a case that it wasn't a dead-end technology because it couldn't be made to go any faster. It's just that there was no further development after that there because it was one of those things. You need a demand. Intel basically was starting to tie up the hardware side of things by the time there were other processors are available around. Microsoft was starting to tie up the desktop side of things based on DOS running on a x86 processor. So it really was just a timing thing. I think that with the Microsoft DOS, ultimately Windows, and Intel x86, it was just a synergy that just really it wiped out everything else. And Apple wanted
that
to be different.
I don't think it's – the market also today is so much faster. We churn through computers a lot quicker than you did, I think, back then. What was the time period between the 64 and the 128, for instance? It was like a couple of years at least.
Yep.
So now you may not see something like that. But so it was that. And also I think it behooves us to mention that the 65 series is still a viable concern. I mean, Western Design Center still produces 658116s, and there are still chips in the 65 line that are in use in industry because they have very good purposes for many things. So
there's solid, reliable packages that are available and are used for basically microcontroller functions. So.
Exactly. And, you know, in the original booklet that MOS produced about the 6502. There's a lot of paragraphs devoted to the fact that there were various versions of it that could be used for different things like driving relays and switches and stuff like that. So the personal computer aspect of it was a part, but it was a part. It wasn't the only part or the only thing about the 6502. So it still has use today. Why it never got faster, I think the market didn't materialize for it, bad timing, and if you want to call it bad timing. And there really wasn't the need. So
there, one other piece of this question that Vince sent was had mm-hmm. to do with the fact that you can, if you have an overclocked Apple II, then you have this, usually there's some option to take it back to one. And I think that is true, that there are certain peripherals do expect to have particular timing. So I know specifically the disk controller can't be accessed at 2 megahertz. And so all of these accelerated computers do have circuitry that when it's addressing slot 6, which is where the disk controller is, it will slow down. Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, there is that too. If you know, just for computers that you have 65X chips in that you have sped up, you know, if you're interacting with things that can't handle it, then you do have to slow down. So there's that aspect too, I suppose, that mm-hmm. you know, to the extent that you don't want to invalidate all of your peripherals and things. Okay, so I think we can move.
Yeah. Well, it was also that got me looking, and I thought, well, the Z80 was the other chip of the day. So I just had a quick look last night about the Z80. So its next generation was the Z800, which was never released, and that was a 8 and 16-bit CPU, address up to 16 meg of RAM, and it was Z80 object code compatible, but never released. And then after that came the Z8000, which was a full 16-bit CPU. It moved on a little bit further as far as generational design, but it too is now really just a niche microcontroller CPU. But it was interesting just to go and have a look at what's happened to the chips of our computers. But sorry to say, Intel basically swamped the market, and that's it, folks. One way or another, we're in Intel land now.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So thanks for the feedback that we did get. If you have other feedback, you can email us at feedback@rcrpodcast.com, which I will put at the end as well, but good to hear from people. Now, okay, so being the host, I will move us along to the items of interest and news, and I will just put in my first item of interest, which is that RCR Podcast alum David Grealish has started a new podcast. Mm-hmm. So the new podcast is The History of Personal Computing. You can find it at historyofpersonalcomputing.com. He's doing this with Jeff Salzman. And they are, they've got one episode, I think they've got a pre-episode up, and I think I'm not sure if the first episode is up after that, but they're sort of going through, focusing on individual systems, so rather than the sort of chatting that we do here mm-hmm. about random things, they're focusing in on individual systems that were important. So so definitely check that out. We accept their challenge, but... Yeah, it sounds like it'll be quite interesting. It also makes me think a little bit of the impression one gets of British television, that there are only a small number of actors working in the entire country, because it does sort of seem like there's a very small number of degrees that you can get from any podcast to any other podcast with. So, Mike, you did some work with Jeff Salzman as well.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, on the Radio Shack catalog stuff, which is still ongoing, I think.
Excellent.
Jeff is Vintage Volts on Twitter. He's great. He's got a good radio voice too.
So definitely we'll be following that and encourage everybody to follow mm-hmm. that as well. Both the history of the personal computing And what is the podcast that you're doing with Jeff? Just reading Radio Shack. What's the title of it?
Oh, the Radio Shack catalogs. I'm not sure what official title Jeff has given to it, but basically what we're doing is we're looking at two different, I guess, eras of catalog. We started out with the late 70s and looked at a Radio Shack catalog, look at the different items in there. Now, Jeff has interested very, not just computers. He's into all kinds of things that are vintage. That's why he's Vintage Volts and not Vintage Computer. And so we get to go through the catalog and look through the various things. And we are in the middle of 83, which is a much bigger catalog than the 77, 78 issue we were looking at before. And commenting on the various things inside of that. You know, I think it's an interesting thing. You know, we both have our various interests, and we go through the catalog page by page and stop on things that catch our fancy or interest.
It's the ones I've heard so far are quite interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So, Michael, you have an auction for us.
Well, it's for those of us who are looking to fill that missing spot in our retro computer collection. Bonhams has another Apple I available. It's being auctioned off on the 22nd of October this year. So,
Okay.
So it might be time to go and empty out the kids' money box and see if you can get the cash together. They've got a price estimate on $300,000 to $500,000. So I think I'm going to have to sit this one out this time. Having just bought a new house, don't quite have the money just sitting around to say, hey dear, I'm just going to go and buy an Apple One computer. But okay, it's interesting. There's another one's popped up. So pop over, have a look, and just like me, dream.
Yeah, it's definitely neat to look at the pictures and that sort of thing.
That's about as close as I'm going to get.
Well, there was one, an Apple One that was brought to Kansas Fest last year.
Right.
So Mike and I saw that. And I think it just made an appearance at there was another computer show. I'm not sure what's going on right now, but it was just at, like, VCF Midwest maybe or something.
I saw the picture online, or no, it was on Facebook. I'm thinking it's the same guy.
Oh yeah, I'm sure it is. We saw it get signed, actually, I think.
Well, I thought he said that he had driven down from Illinois at the time, and then, you know, Waz was at KFest. I mean, how fortuitous. Well, that's why he came down, as I recall,
right?
And so Waz was there and was able to sign it. I asked Waz to program something on it, but he said he could at one time.
Yeah.
So,
let's see. So, and of course, you know, Mike, we grabbed you with no warning to come in on the show. So, was there anything that you wanted to any news that you wanted to put in here?
Well, I'll tell you that next item that you have on the list is really exciting to me. So you can jump right into that. I think.
Or you could give it. It doesn't matter.
It's been a while since I read it. I mean, we can talk about it in general. I think Chris Osborne, who goes by FOZZTEXX, FozTex on Twitter, had figured out a way to use, what was it? It was like PBXs that he bought and put together. That guy is amazing. He put together PBXs so he could dial into bulletin boards without actually having landlines in his office. It was astounding. It's a really, really good story to read about, especially if you're fascinated with modems and old BBS technology like I am.
Yeah, he has a video sort of demonstrating it, and actually it seems like he got pretty high speeds. I forget what it was, but he was hoping for 300 baud and actually managed to get, you know, many thousands of baud.
I think he got up to 38.4. Mm-hmm. I'm fairly certain. So certainly usable for anything at the time, you know, that could be run today. So, and quite honestly, you know, if you call those BBSs, if they're still up and running, if they've been transferred over to Telnet, you want the 2400 or 9600 experience, right?
Exactly.
So,
yeah, so the video is neat, just because you can hear the video, the modem sounds and things. By the way, I'm pretty sure he's the one that also has the Apple IIgs BBS up that you can call.
Yes.
So,
although it wasn't up today, I was trying it out today because I was testing some stuff.
What is
earlier.
It called? I can't remember now.
Let's see, I know it's bbs.fostex.net.com, rather.
Yeah, bbs.fostex.com is... Yeah. That gives you the details of what you need. So he's got the dial-up details, telnet, and raw sockets, mm-hmm. and web browser. So pop over to that. We'll include it in the show notes, and whichever way you can get there, there's your four ways of connecting in and to get some BBS experience if you've never used one.
Although to follow his lead is going to take a little bit of work.
Yeah.
So you might want to try, like, you know, maybe getting an emulator that can support, you know, piping out to Netcat or SoCat or something and dialing out to a BBS that's being hosted over Telnet or something.
At least it gives you the opportunity to use a web browser. So as he said, no old school computer handy, just want to try it out. So he gives you a link to Shell in a Box, you just connect into that. And that will give you the experience. And then if you want to go further, grab your Commodore, grab your Apple, whatever, and connect in old school if you want to.
Yeah, I think it's called Level 29 or something like that. But
That's it.
And I'm currently there's some game I should have actually
I know what you're talking about, yeah.
I should have actually looked this up ahead of time, but there's a game where you're sort of like you're driving around trying to avoid all these robots that come in after you, and I'm last I checked I was the by far the high score holder, so somebody has to come beat me. Okay.
I tried.
Michael, you have sad news
to report. It's more sad news. The print Macworld magazine is no more. They're basically closing up shop. I believe the November issue this year is going to be the final issue. They'll only have a web presence, and even that they're saying that there's going to be reduced staff working on the web presence. So Macworld magazine was... announced, I suppose, released in conjunction with the Apple Macintosh in 84. There was a little bit of work with Steve Jobs and the magazine publishers at that stage to get that up and running at the same time. So they've been running the 30 years that the Mac's been running. But as a lot of print magazines are finding, it's very difficult to survive in the internet age where people are able to get the information and the news fairly much immediately rather than waiting for their monthly fix to come out in print via the news agent or via subscription. It's sad, but I was surprised that they've lasted that long.
Well, it is very sad, but at least Amiga World is still going strong.
Yes.
No.
And Juice GS.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. That first Macworld cover is a pretty iconic one. I can picture it with Steve Jobs kind of presenting the Macintosh to the group, to the world. They're still going on. I mean, Macworld is going to continue as a name. But it's not the same thing, mm-hmm. unfortunately.
Although I have to admit that I haven't read the print magazine, for a very long time. So,
yeah.
I mean, I'm part of the problem.
Me too. I haven't either.
Yeah. Okay. So time is ticking on. I think we'll move on here. So I am the host. I will give you the host retro computing gift idea, and the theme I have picked is having to do with the fact that we just lost Doug Smith. It is a Lode Runner video game retro 80s T-shirt. So it looks kind of neat. You can take a look at the link. It's the edition in the picture at least is just it's a black shirt with a Lode Runner screen on it. And, you know, I think this would be a nice sort of respectful thing to wear. Yes. So, and it's, now I've moved away from the page, but it's not too expensive, $20. So.
No.
Okay. And now other places to spend money. So we have eBay auctions. We have only a couple. So, Michael, did you want to put in your...
Well, I'll kick off. I thought that seeing that this is the year that Windows was announced, and I thought just to preempt our 85 show where it's actually released. But over on Vintage Computer Museum, they've got available on eBay Windows 1 in its beautiful blue box, 5 1/4 inch floppy disks. And what floored me is that their normal asking price of $999, it's currently, from I can see here on special, save $120, only $880.
Jeez.
But, yeah. So I'm just sort of thinking, oh, I wonder if you can really get that much for it, and do I really need to keep my original copy? I think that this one might be on the shelf for a while, and I think I might just keep mine for a bit longer. But, yeah.
It's neat to see.
I know Windows sells for a lot these days, but... it's a bit pricey for Windows 1, but it's an interesting product.
Well, and I think it's neat to see the package. I mean, you know, I think the auction is not, it's not for the general public. You know, I think no one, I don't think this is worth that much. And I think actually this particular seller just tends to do that. You know, he'll sort of, I'm going to keep this, and you know, unless someone wants to really, really pay a lot for it, is I think the attitude he's got. But
yeah, he's got a lot of stuff.
Not that I've seen I haven't seen too many come up on eBay or anywhere else actually for sale. So if someone is actually after the original box, original discs, it's not one of the easiest pieces of software to find. You know, a lot of other Microsoft stuff early is. Quite, I'll put common in quotes, but it's a lot more freely available for purchase than what Windows 1 is. The one that I'm finding most difficult to add to my collection is actually Windows 2. That I'm finding very difficult to track down, because that was the first version of Windows I actually used in a work environment on an IBM PS2. So, yeah, I'll keep looking for that one. But if anyone does have a spare grand and not quite enough to go buy an Apple One, but they've got enough to buy a Windows One, go for it, guys.
Great. Okay, so I have a couple, just a couple things to list. One of them is a 32K RAM upgrade for the Mattel Aquarius. We were talking about the Aquarius earlier. This is... it's a little bit interesting. I kind of wanted to point it out just because it's... I think it's a like a modern... it's not an original thing. It's a more modern replacement for the RAM modules that you could get. So Mattel originally had 4K and 16K. They may, I don't think they had an original 32K. Am I just making this up? But I don't think so. So so this is by someone who has constructed these. And I think from looking at the listing, I think it's actually also the same person who makes the AquariCart. For some reason, the AquariCart does not pop up on my eBay searches, so I don't notice that it's when it's being listed. But it is, yes, the seller has those as well. And so those, if you have an Aquarius and you're interested in it, I think these are worth looking at, just because 32K memory, first of all, is enough to do what you want to do.
It's massive for the Aquarius.
But I think I think it had 4K or something without any expansion, and that's not enough to do anything. So
you could print something to the screen. I did that.
Right.
Hello!
The AquariCart, I'm sure we've mentioned this before, but that is a pretty cool thing. It has basically all of the released software and a couple of other things all in a sort of menu selectable cartridge. So that's... you know, that's definitely, if you want to actually use an Aquarius and not just write your own programs for it, that's definitely worth checking out. And then I guess the other thing I had listed was a Jupiter Ace, just because I think these things are cool. And I like the fact that this one started off, at least, is it still there? It started off at 99 pence? 0.99.
Yep. Yeah, so pounds. There's one bid on it at the moment, so
it's not going to end anywhere near that. These things are actually quite rare, and this one looks This one looks very clean, and it has a 16K RAM expansion, which has got to be at least as rare as the computer. So so it's interesting to look at. I think a couple episodes ago we had highlighted the fact that the whole Jupiter Ace name was being put for sale, and I don't know what happened to that. But if you want just the computer, the little fourth computer.
Now, was that on, that was an eBay auction, wasn't it? The Jupiter name?
It was, and it ended, and I'm not sure. Like, it didn't get sold on eBay. I'm not sure exactly what happened to it after that.
I see.
But, and that's actually it as far as the eBay things that we have on our show notes. So we'll put the links to those. You can take a look at those. And I think, actually, we're running up right against the end of the time that we have. Mm-hmm. So I will close it off by asking if anyone has any things they want to add to this. Michael, what's up? How do you want to close?
Well, okay, there's the biggie for down here in Australia is that OzKFest is dates are locked in. So April 17 to 19 next year is going to be at Keysborough in Melbourne. I'll link to the announcement and also to the OzKFest website. So basically we're now putting out a call for presentations. So anyone here in Australia or anywhere else wanting to drop in, if you have an idea of what you'd like to do for a presentation, contact details are on the OzKFest.net website. Drop us a line and hopefully we'll be able to get some good numbers. I think we had about 30 people in all turn up to our last OzKFest in Brisbane. So it's a small community, but we do like to get together as often as we can. It's currently working out to being every other year at the moment. This time we're going to do it in April so that it doesn't clash with KFest over in the US, which is good from my perspective.
Never clashes.
It makes it difficult to attend both of them, but I'm intending to go to KFest in 2015, so I can actually do both of them.
Cool.
Neat. So of course, this is primarily an Apple II centered conference.
Yes. Yeah.
Is it to what extent do people, other sort of retro computing enthusiasts show up? Because I know that that's one of the things that happens at Kansas Fest here. Is that something? Do you invite all?
Anyone can come along and join us. We've had people who have picked up an Apple II and got interested in it, heard about us, they've come along. It, like Kansas Fest, it is oriented around the Apple II, but no, if you're into Atari or Commodore and you want to come along and join in some Apple fun, we're not going to turn you away. We'd also love to hear from you about your other than Apple computing experiences, because whatever the platform, there are great stories from what you were doing back then, what you're doing now, how you're interfacing with the modern world. It's great. So, if you're not an Apple II person and you want to come along, by all means, click on the website, find out the details, book it in, and drop in and find out how the other half compute.
Right.
And all that is why Drop 3 Inches is going to be performing live at OzKFest.
Yep. All we need is the tickets paid for.
Oh.
Great. Yeah, that'll be exciting. And maybe you'll have a better success rate at streaming video than we did at Kansas Fest this last time. Let's see. For me, let's see. Mike, what's any closing thoughts?
Closing thoughts for me. Well, I appreciate you having me.
I very much appreciate
minute,
you coming.
Which is why I don't have a lot to say. But no, I appreciate it. I appreciate you thinking about me. And it's always fun. I always enjoy this podcast. I listen to it every time it comes out. So thank you.
Thanks. And for me, I think, there's I have many, many things on the to-do list and playing around with the Apple III and cleaning up my office, but I guess that's basically it. So Next time we'll be talking about the 1984. So if there's anything that you want us not to be sure to not miss, send us feedback about that.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I guess I will close it out. So that's it. You can find show notes for all of the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss this in the forums at vintagecomputer.com/VC forum. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. You can send us feedback at feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And we are a proud member of the Throwback Network, which is at throwbacknetwork.net. So until next time, retro compute.
Retro compute.